Welcome to Rebecca and Finn's story. Rebecca has been very courageous to share with us her beautiful son, Finn, and her journey through grief with First Light, in a hope that other brave parents can connect to her story and seek the support if they need it. My name is Georgia Howard and I'm the Clinical Services Director here in First Light. First Light is a trauma-informed organisation and offers free therapy to bereaved parents. If you or a loved one are struggling with the sudden death of a child and are seeking support, reach out on our website and send in a referral because we are here to help. This story contains discussion of the death of a child, details of which you may find upsetting. If you find this content upsetting and need support, reach out to First Light. We're here to help.
My name is Rebecca, first of all. My son Finn was born on the 8th of March 2021. He weighed in at 7 pounds, 11 ounces. Perfectly healthy. Flying, delighted with life. And that's basically the part of the story, the good part of the story. He was perfectly healthy. He was discharged from the hospital 2 days later. We brought him home. Absolutely perfect. Amazing 2 weeks. My mum had died 18 months previously, so we were all looking to be on the up, I suppose, and we were delighted to have him. And, you know, it was like we had turned a corner after the death of my mum, I suppose. Yeah. Very placid child, very, you know, just really kind of placid, easygoing, wasn't cranky. Now, we know since that it's entirely possible that he wasn't cranky because of what transpired later on, but that he was a fairly placid child, really healthy, had gone, you know, to the hospital, been back for the checkups. They had found nothing wrong. He was completely and utterly healthy and, you know, funny, and kind of the little personality was starting to come out and things like that already. So he was just a pleasant child, or a very pleasant disposition. And I think he would have been like that in later life, that he would have just been a very very laid back type of person. I brought Finn to the hospital on Tuesday morning, I brought him to the doctor on the Tuesday morning for the 2 week check. He was perfectly fine, absolutely healthy. She had a quick look at him. She done the tummy marks and everything else, checked his eyes, checked his ears, checked his bum, checked his nose, the whole lot, you know, and he was perfectly fine. And she sent me on my way. She said he might have, I had told her he had a little bit of constipation. She said, don't be worrying about it. In the doctors, he had a little bit of a grunt. And I said, is that anything to worry about? And she said, not at all. The doctor said, she said, that's just him trying to go to the toilet. Yeah. You know, she said, he'd be absolutely fine. And that was grand. And then my sister had come up that evening. She was home to stay for the week, just to get the cuddles in and the whole lot, you know, because that was her first nephew. So she was delighted and she was like, oh, yeah, I can't wait. I'm so chuffed, blah, blah, blah. We went home and he was perfectly fine. And we were sitting around chatting and all of a sudden my husband had him in his arms and he went floppy, Elaine. And Kev opened his nappy and there was tiny, tiny little spot of blood. Like so tiny a spot that if he'd gone to the toilet in the nappy, you wouldn't have seen it, right? Now, it transpired later on that was actually nothing to do with anything. Yeah. So Kev said, just for the best, he said, I think I'll bring him to hospital. That was fine. We went to the hospital. Well, I didn't go because of COVID. So I stayed at home. So we were only allowed one parent in at the time. So Kev went, and I am not a person that likes hospitals, and I think of myself, sure, the doctor had told me he was grand 5 hours before. Do you know what I mean?
A bit of peace of mind.
Exactly. So this was at, say, around 7:30, 8 o'clock, right? Because I remember just before that, my sister had turned around and she'd said, I'm after getting coffee to slice. And she says, we'll sit down and we'll watch Bake Off and we'd be grand, and then he'll wake up for the bottle and I'll sort it out and I'm delighted in the whole lot, right? So that's grand. And so Kev brings him to the hospital. And I don't know what's going on, right? But it has transpired since that when he got to the hospital, the nurse, she was lovely, but she said to Kev, it's probably just that he's, you know, you're a new parent, you're a bit anxious, the whole lot. Now, Kev said she was absolutely lovely. She says, no worries. She says, I'll check him out. She put an SP monitor on his finger. an oxygen saturation monitor on his finger, and she says his heart rate is a little bit high. She says, but hold on, this one might be broken. I'll just get another one, right? So that's fine. She gets another one. And then really things start to go very wrong very, very quickly. And she says, no, there's a problem. She says, his heart rate is very, very high. Just let me get the doctor. And she called in a doctor. And they brought him into the resource room in the infant part of Talla Hospital, which is now different. It's a totally different part of the hospital now than it was then. And I've since been back and it's totally different. So actually it's good for me that it doesn't look the same, I suppose. But so they brought him in and Kev rang me and he says, they're telling me to call you to the hospital. And I said, for what? And he said, I don't know, but it looks like things are very wrong. And that's fine. So I go to the hospital and Kev is sitting outside and he is white as a sheet. And all of a sudden I hear all these beeping monitors. And it transpires that Finn is having a heart attack. Right? And a doctor comes out to me. Her name is Sheena Durkin. And she says to me, come in to me, she says. And that's grand. I go in and I keep saying to her, but what's wrong with him? And she keeps saying his heart is very quick. I don't really know what's wrong with him. And I'm wearing a mask. And she says to me, give him a kiss. She says, I'm going to put him asleep. And I says, for what? And she says, I need to give him a rest. And so I give him a kiss. But my mask is still on. And I stand back and I don't realise at the time what's happening. And so she says to me, give him a little kiss. Take your mask off, she says, and give him a little kiss. And so I give him a kiss. And I'm holding his hand and he looks at me. And he looks at me as if to be like, this is the last time you're going to see me the way I am now. So, and she sends me out. And she stays in. And we're waiting and we're waiting. And a nurse, the most loveliest nurse, comes out and she says, are you all right? Can I get you a drink of water? Can I do anything for you? And a junior doctor comes to me and he says, what's your child's name? And, you know, has he got anything wrong with him? And they asked me to explain that he was after being in the doctor earlier on and all these kind of things. And at this stage, I don't know what's wrong. All I can hear is all this beeping going on, right? And it just keeps beeping and beeping and beeping. And I keep saying to Kev, what is that? I don't know what that is. Why won't he come out? Why won't he tell me anything? And you're in such a space that you don't, it's like you're sitting on your own shoulder being like, this is like a horror film. What is the story? Why is this happening to me? Do you know? And at the time, you don't even realise it's happening to you, Elaine. You're just looking at yourself as if to be like, oh God, if this was my life, I think I'd be sick. Do you know? Because it had all happened so quickly, Elaine. You're talking, bringing him to the hospital at 8 o'clock and at 10:30, they're telling you, there's such a big problem. And then anyway, a doctor comes out to me and he's wearing a checkered shirt and he's grey hair, right? And I'll see him till the day I die, right? And he's grey hair and it's cut real tight. And he kneels down in front of me. So Kev is here, I'm here and Adrian's here. And he kneels down in front of me and he says, I'm so sorry. He says, I don't think your child is going to survive. And me being me and not knowing what's after happening, I'm like, what? I brought him to the doctor. What? I don't understand. And I'm shouting at this man and this poor man doesn't know why I'm shouting at him. And I'm shouting at him and shouting at him and shouting at him. And he can't tell me anything because he knows what's wrong. But he knows what's happening, but he doesn't know how it has come to be so wrong, if you get me. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, but I don't understand. I don't understand. I don't understand. And I just keep shouting at him and shouting at him and shouting at him. And to be honest, Lane, how the man didn't clatter me, I don't know. Because I'm just screaming at him. So then that's grand, right? And we go in. The doctor comes out and Sheena comes out and she brings us to the family waiting room. And she says to me, we're trying to stabilise him for transport. And I says, I don't know what that means. And she says, I really have to tell you, she says, things do not look good. She says, I'm trying to stabilise him for transport to Crumlin. They have a special machine there called ECMO. And I haven't got a clue. She may as well be telling me that he's going on a flight to China because I haven't got a clue. Yeah. Right? And I say, yeah. And she's looking at me as if to be like, you haven't got a clue what I'm talking about. Right? Now, she was a lovely, lovely doctor, but at the time, I think I had just been like, no, shut down, not listening, don't care. Do you know, just save my child. And that's fine. And so she says, do you want to go back out into the parts that you were in already? And that's fine. And you're sitting there and you're sitting there and it's getting later and later and later. And all the while the beeping is going off and it's getting more and more incessant. And you're worried about it. But again, it's like you have shut down. And the you who's sitting up here is watching the telly because your life is on like a television screen. And they're like, oh my God, that poor girl. Imagine what it would be like to be in her life. And the you sitting in the chair has decided, no, I'm not doing any of it now. I don't care. So you've totally like, it's like somebody just turned you off. And so that's fine. And the beeping goes on and on and on. And all of a sudden the beeping stops. And a doctor who I've met since came out to me. And his name is Jan Franta. And he says to me, hiya, Rebecca. He says, I'm the transport doctor. So I'm thinking, well, where round you up now? Because we're going to Crumlin. So the beeping is after stopping. We're going to Crumlin. They're Mickey Mousey doctors here. They're real doctors in Crumlin. Right? That's what I'm thinking, Elaine. In my brain, that is not working. That's the hope. These are fake doctors. Not that they're fake doctors, but they're like, oh, we deal with everything. But I'm thinking, get them to the hospital where they deal with the babies and we're on the up, you know? So that's fine. And he says, right, he says, there'll be six doctors in the ambulance and Finn will be in the incubator. So I say, yeah. And I says, and there'll be a seat for me. And he says, no. And he says to me, things are very bad, he says. We need all the doctors. We need all the spaces on the transport ambulance to get him to Crumlin. And he says to me, he might die on the road. And I screamed in his face, not going to lie. I screamed in his face, you're telling me my child might die on the road and I'm not going to be there. And he says, yes, he says, and I'm so sorry, but I need all these spaces. So that's fine. So then the nurse who had been dealing with us, her name was Kat, she brought us out to a waiting taxi, right? And she put a slip in Kev's hand that said, parents X3, right? And the driver in the taxi, to be fair to him, he obviously does this all the time because when I tell you, we got to Crumlin directly behind the ambulance. We did, within 10 seconds. They weren't even opening the ambulance door when your man dropped up us in the taxi, right? So that's grand. And waiting at the door is a doctor who I since know very well, Terry Prendable. He says to me, okay, he says, I'm going to bring him up to the ward. I'm going to get him settled, see what I can do, and the whole lot, right? He says, I'll be back to you in a while. He says, it could be an hour, could be 2 hours. I need to see where we are, right? So I'm thinking, he hasn't mentioned death. He hasn't mentioned anything. He knows what he's talking about. We're on the up, right? So that's grand. And we go into the waiting room. And that's fine. And we're waiting. And we're waiting. And we're waiting. And the three of us again are sitting in this line. Just white with shock. Can't talk. Don't know what's happening. Don't know basically where we are, who we are. Anything, because 2 hours previous he was perfect. So now you're getting to about now, I think it's about, could be 11:30, 11:45, right? And it has since transpired that Kev had rang his own parents and my dad at the time, right? So that was fine. And my dad rocks up at the hospital and he says to me, what's wrong? And I says, I don't know. And he says, but what did they tell you? I said, they just keep saying, heart, heart, heart. I don't know what's wrong. I don't know what's wrong. So that's fine. And then my dad goes for a cup of tea and Terry comes in and that's fine. And Terry is sitting. I'm sitting here. Kev's sitting here. Adrian's sitting here. Terry is sitting right beside me. There's a nurse sitting beside him. And he says, it's going to be a long time, he says. But if I can save him, you'll be here for months, not weeks. So in my head, Elaine, I'm thinking, if I can save him, he thinks he can do something, right? So that's grand. He says his heart is going very, very quickly. It turns out that his heart is beating at 270 beats per minute, right? So Terry says to me, it's looking like we'd be here months, not weeks. So that's fine. He says, about ECMO and what tells me what that is, but I'm not listening because I can't. It's not that I'm not listening. I actually can't listen because I'm like, no, this can't be my life. Right. So he's telling me ECMO, but we're not there yet. We think that there's things to do before ECMO. So that's fine. Right. And the night wears on and it wears on and we don't see Terry again. And that's grand. And they send us up to the parents' accommodation inside in Crumlin Hospital. So that's fine. And 7:30 that morning, the following morning, I get a phone call from a nurse, the clinical nurse manager on the ward called Lorraine. And she says to me, come down, she says. So that's grand. And there's urgency in her voice, right? And we're going down so quickly that we get lost in the grounds of the hospital. Yeah, so it had transpired then when we got down that they told us they thought he was going to die and that's why they called us down. But so Lorraine, in her haste to get us down to the hospital door, she had opened the door, but we had gotten lost. And in the heel of the hunt, anyway, Terry managed to stabilise him again. And at this point, I think he's after having 3 heart attacks. So he had 2 in Talla. And he's after having another heart attack now at 7:30. He is 15 days when he went into school, into hospital. So 16 days on this day. Right? So he was after having 3 heart attacks. Yeah. And so then I suppose what happens is they're telling you things are not looking good here. And you've come down off the extreme high of shock, terror, the whole lot. So you're thinking, okay, things are not looking good here. But Terry keeps saying, we can try this and we can try that and we can try the other. So that's fine. So they save him after that heart attack and they send us into the parents' waiting room. And a nurse keeps coming in with sandwiches and cups of tea, basically anything just to fill your day, to know. And I go and I have a shower because I've been in my pajamas now since the time when Kev called me to come into the hospital. I was ready for bed, ready to sit down, watch Bake Off, the whole lot, you know. When Kev rang me, he was in such terror that I just went to the hospital, right? And I'm still in my pajamas that I'd been wearing the night before. And that's fine. And so I go and I have a shower. And things start to look a little bit clearer because you know yourself, Elaine, when you've had a wash and you're okay, I can deal with this a bit better now. Right. And a doctor comes in and her name is Helen Daly. And she is the intensivist on the ward. And she says to me, his heart is beating too quickly. It's worn out. Right. And I say immediately, I'm on it like a car bonnet. And I say, heart transplant. And she tells me to sit down. And she says, we don't have baby hearts. And I keep saying to her, there must be something. There has to be something you can do. There has to be something you can do. So that's fine. And you go back into the waiting room. The day wears on and it wears on. Different nurses, different doctors are coming in and out and in and out. And you're signing all these forms. And at one point, my dad is sitting beside me. And I turn around to my dad and I say, how have I to sign all these forms? And because I have only been a parent at this point for 16 days. And I'm signing all these forms for them to do things to my baby that I never thought I'd have to do. And I'm wondering, how come this responsibility is on me? Because I am only a parent 16 days. I don't know what I'm talking about. I haven't got a clue. You're signing all these forms and you're signing all these forms and that's fine. And Terry comes in and he goes out and he's talking about different things. And the word ECMO is coming up more and more often. And another doctor, Mark Webb, comes in and he says to me, he says, we'd like to put him on ECMO. And at this stage, Terry is after explaining to me what ECMO is, but I still don't really have a clue, right? And I say to this doctor, I say, is this his only chance? And is this his best chance, I say to him. And he says, he looks at me and he says, Rebecca, this is his only chance. So he hands me the form and I sign the form. And to be perfectly honest, that form could have been telling me, Elaine, cut your own leg off there, Rebecca. No painkillers, no nothing. Then cut your own head off. And because I hadn't got a clue what I was signing. Not going to lie, right? Now, quite possibly, and I'm telling you now because they were great in the hospital, they told me what all these forms were about. But in my haste and in my dissociated state, I suppose, I was like, whatever, I don't care. I'm just signing all these forms. So that's fine. And that's grand. And they're doing different brain scans and head scans and heart scans and all these horrible scans that I have no clue about, right? So that's fine. And the day wears on and different nurses and doctors and things are coming in and out. And a nurse comes in called Helene Merchant, and she's the cardiac specialist nurse on the heart ward in Crumlin Hospital. A very, very nice lady. And she is talking to us and she's telling us what they might be able to do and when Finn gets a little bit older and all these kind of things. So again, Elaine, I'm thinking, we're on the up. Do you know? Yeah. And she's telling me about a pacemaker maybe when he turns 10. And I'm thinking, I turn around to Kevin. I'm like, when he turns 10, they have this. They know what the story is. Do you know what I mean? And at that time, Terry has told us what Finn has, right? And yes, it is a serious illness and all of that, but you can recover. It was called ectopic atrial tachycardia. So it's basically when there are rogue cells in the heart, and they tell the heart, these few rogue cells, and Terry said it might have been a few hundred cells in all the millions of cells in the heart, are telling the heart how fast to be, right? So he mentions then when Finn gets a little bit older about a pacemaker and then about a thing called cardioablation, where they might basically burn the rogue cells so that they don't send any signals anymore. So the way Terry explained it was like a disruption in a train station. So you're thinking at the time, okay, we're on the up. And that's fine. And the previous night, Terry had said about ECMO, but that we weren't there yet. And so then we did all the heart scans and the brain function scans. And they haven't told us at this point that Finn's brain function was dramatically lowered because he had to be resuscitated after the heart attacks. So after every heart attack, he had to be resuscitated, right? And that's fine. And they put him on ECMO in the end anyway, and it's absolutely horrific. It's horrendous, right? So what happens is it's basically Finn was asleep, but they give his heart and his lungs a rest, and so this machine is doing the work, right? So it's pumping the blood around the body, and there's this big red tube going from his neck into this big machine. And at this point, there's a nurse sitting constantly at the machine and she cannot leave. Now, I don't know that at this point, but she is not allowed to leave because this machine is what's keeping Finn alive. And I do not know that at this point. Okay. And so that's okay. And Terry is saying, you know, we're giving him a rest. He needs it. And they just keep saying, a rest, a rest, a rest. He needs a break. He needs a rest. He's tired. He's after running 10 marathons, all these kind of things. And I'm wondering, what's going on? What's going on? What's going on? And while the ECMO is going on, they are running all these different scans. So they're running brain function tests, ECGs, EKGs, all these different types of tests, right? And they put him on a blood thinner to stop the blood coagulating. And they tell me that it's possible that he could have a bleed on the brain and he would die straight away. And I say, okay. And turns out then he doesn't have a bleed on the brain. So again, I'm thinking we're on the up. No worries. So what happens then is things really do start to go downhill then. And Terry says to me, we'll give it 3 days to see if things work. And all the while they're doing these function tests, and Helen keeps coming in and out, and Helene keeps coming in and out, and Terry keeps coming in and out, and other nurses are coming in and out, and the nurse is stuck to this machine all the while, and she basically only changes to go on a shift change. They've shaved a little bit of his head. He has a wire, like a tube coming into his body, a red tube. He has tubes in his nose. He has tubes in his belly. He has, and he's lying basically on this bed, and he's swollen. He is so, so swollen because at this point his kidneys don't function. Yeah. And basically, I don't think really, and I've since learned, Elaine, but I don't think really anything functions at this stage. Okay, so, but his lips keep sucking, right? And his eyes keep opening. And I'm thinking, they haven't got a clue. They keep telling me he's not going to survive, but his lips are moving and his eyes are moving and he keeps looking at me, right? And I say to the nurse, could he be hungry? And she says, he can't feel hunger anymore. And she's very, very nice about it. They're all lovely, but your world is falling apart, so you just keep nodding and saying yeah, and that's fine. And they do all the tests, and Helen comes back, and we're sitting in the waiting room, and she explains everything to me, and there's a nurse sitting beside her called Orla Boyce, and myself and Kev are sitting again on the left, and Helen and Orla are sitting here. And I say to her, just tell me one thing, I say. And she says, all right. And I say, is he going to die on me? And she says to me, I do think he will die, Rebecca. And something broke inside me then, Elaine. I basically fall on the floor and I am screaming. And I mean, not crying, I am screaming. And again, this person is sitting on my shoulder being like, oh my God, I have never heard a sound like that in my life. And I'm thinking inside my head, who is making that noise? Do you know? And so that's fine. And again, you're sitting there and you're sitting there and you keep going down into this like spaceship type room with all these new mod cons and all these new machines. And you're thinking, with all of this, how can they not save him? You know? And that's fine. And you're up and down the stairs of the hospital. You're seeing other kids walking around and things like that. And I keep saying to Kev, but it's not fair. What about Finn? You know? And so in the heel of the hunt, anyway, they come back with these forms to sign, and these forms are to turn off life support. And Helen says to me, she says, it's not fair because he has no quality of life, and he will have no quality of life because his brain at this point, because of the subsequent heart attacks and the heart going like the clappers, he has no brain function. Mm-hmm. And basically the ECMO is what's keeping him alive. And you wait a little while and eventually the nurses are telling you, take your time, come down whenever you like, you know, all these kind of things. And you're like, this can't be happening. So I'm trying to stave off time as much as I can, you know, so I won't go down and see him, because I'm like, as soon as I go down and see him, they're going to be like, it's time now, you know. So, and that is something I regret to this day, not going down. But I'm not going down because the longer I'm up here, the more time he's still alive, you know. So that's all right. And we go down and Helen puts these two big leather chairs together. And she says, okay, she says, we're going to start the process. She says, I'll turn off all the beeping. I'll turn off all the monitors and all of these things, right? So that's fine. And Finn is on the bed here and the two leather chairs are sitting like this. And that's grand. And she says, and she explains absolutely everything. And she says, I'm going to take out this tube. I'm going to take out that tube. I'm going to take out all the other tubes. And at this point, a doctor has come along who has removed the ECMO. So he is on a different type of life support now. But there are two big machines on either side of the bed, which what have now I have come to know have basically like medication pumps, pumping all different medications into all different wires in his feet, in his hands, in his nose, in his elbows, everywhere. So he's covered in wires and he is quite solo. So he looks like a different baby. And all the while I'm thinking, I have completely lost my mind now, because I'm thinking, how do they know that's my baby? He doesn't look the same. That could be anybody's baby. Maybe it's not mine. Maybe they've made a mistake. And so that's fine. And so Helen comes along and she's removing all these wires and all this beeping is happening and there's nurses everywhere and all of this kind of stuff. And I'm sitting on the left-hand side and Kev's sitting on the right-hand side. And she puts Finn in my arms and he has no tubes. He has no wires. He has no nothing. He is just naked apart from the nappy and he's lying in my arms. And she says his breathing will stop. But it doesn't. And it goes on and it goes on and it goes on. And all the while I'm thinking, they've made a mistake. He's going to be fine. He might not be the same, but he's going to live. And he's breathing. And obviously Elaine, his breathing does eventually stop because they're doctors and they know what they're talking about, right? But it's the hope in my head that's like, they haven't got a clue. This is the wrong child. This is all wrong. This is not my baby. Even if it is my baby, they're going to live anyway because look, sure, they're still breathing, right? And his breathing does eventually stop. And after that, then a nurse comes along and she takes handprints and footprints and locks of hair and she lets you wash them and all these kind of things. And you go back to this room in the hospital called the butterfly room. And it's basically for time with your child before they take him away to the mortuary. Okay. And so that's exactly as I remember it. Now I've probably forgotten bits and pieces and things have gotten a little bit blurred over time. But that's what happens in the hospital up to that point. So then that's the Tuesday, Wednesday. We're talking about the Saturday morning now, I think, that he's gone. And you've dressed him and you're in the hospital and that's fine. So they allow you to spend the Friday night and the Saturday morning in the hospital. And basically then a nurse comes and she says, we'd like to take him down to the mortuary for everything to happen, for embalming and for everything to happen before he goes. And so that's fine. And so they send you home. And while you're gone, Finn is in the mortuary now. The nurses are taking fabulous care of him. He is being embalmed and all of that kind of stuff. And my brother had actually made the arrangements for the funeral and the coffin to be delivered and the cuddle cot and all these kind of things that I have absolutely no recollection of or want to know about, to be perfectly honest, because at this point I'm like, but why me? I must have done something wrong. It must be my fault. What happened? Have I done something wrong in a previous life to get me here to this point now? Have I done something wrong in this life to get me here to this point now? And that's, you know, all these thoughts are going around in your head and nobody has said anything. Nobody has been like, oh, eventually you will leave this hospital and there won't be a baby. And you kind of don't get that, Elaine. You're kind of like, hold on, I had a perfectly healthy baby and now I'm walking out of the hospital and I have no baby. And nobody is like doing anything about it. And there's people walking up and down the street and you want to be like, do you not realise my baby's after dying? How are you like still functioning? My baby's after dying. And so we go home anyway and the undertaker comes and he delivers the coffin and all this kind of stuff. And that's fine. And then we get a phone call from the hospital to say, you can come and collect him. And I'm like, deadly, right? So we go to the hospital and we're brought around the back of the hospital into the mortuary, and it's lovely. It's really, really peaceful, and it's lovely, and the nurses are lovely, and he's dressed in clothes that I had left for him and a little blanket, and that's fine. And she hands me a letter, one of the nurses, and she says, "This is in case you get stopped by the police." And she says, "You can hold him all the way home." And I says, "Bye, Vicarcy." And she says to me, she puts her hand on my arm and she says, "You're not going to need your car seat. It's all right." And it was kind of, I think that was the moment, Elaine, that I realised he's dead. He is actually dead. Right? And again, for the second time, third time, fourth time, I can't even remember how many times in 4 days, my world is just turned on its head, you know, and that's fine. And we go home and there's the cuddle cot and we're able to take him in and out and kiss him and rub him and the whole lot. And he starts to go shiny because nobody will leave him alone. And we're changing him and they tell me he will leak from the mouth, he will leak from the wound and he will leak from his under regions. So that's fine. And yes, he does. He leaks blood from his mouth and his wound in the neck, so you have to change his clothes. Because I didn't realise it's not like when an adult person dies, because he was only a baby, you could pick him up and you could, so things did move, do you know? He would leak and things like that. But as the days wear on, so we have him at home for 2 days, and as the time wears on, he starts to go down. The swelling starts to go down and he starts to come back to himself. And, you know, we're bringing him up and down to the cot in the bedroom and he's sitting in the pram in the corner and people coming in and out and rubbing him and loving him and hugging him and the whole lot. And you kind of don't realise, Elaine, that eventually, even though he is dead, and you know he's dead now at this point, he will have to go, you know. And you don't realise, and you're reading him stories and obviously you're not feeding him or anything like that, but you are changing him. And these kind of things, because he is leaking. So you don't realise really then that he does have to go. And so he does go then. The coffin is in the house and you put him in the coffin. And we went out in the car to Sutton Cemetery where my mum is buried and he's buried in with my mum. And it was only after everything then settled, Elaine, that you were like, what do I do now? Yeah. Like, I had a baby and now, at this point, you don't even have the box. Yeah. You know? Because they've taken clay impressions and all this kind of thing. And you have a few locks of hair and a few bits and pieces, a few photographs. But it's like somebody lent you a baby. And now that baby is gone home. And so we are like, did this happen to me? And that's when you really start, your mind starts to go a bit then and you start being like, did this happen to me? I'm so angry. I'm so angry because it did happen to me and nobody will listen. And maybe other people can deal with it better than I can. You know, they walk out of the hospital and they just get on with their lives. And I feel like at the time that there's nobody... Nobody understands, nobody will help, you don't know what to do, where to turn, any of that kind of stuff. And basically, I was lost, I didn't know what to do. So basically, for the first few weeks, I'm living in probably what my dad would call the time tunnel. So you don't know what's happening, you're suicidal. You keep screaming at people. You're like, I don't think you understand. I had left the hospital the first time with a living baby and now I'm coming out with a box. That's not normal. And you're so angry at everybody and you're angry and you're upset and you cannot get your feelings across. And then I go to my own doctor and she says to me, would you see the psychiatrist in the Coombe? And I said I would, and that's fine. But to make that appointment in the Coombe, I had to go through the main doors where all these mothers who are heavily pregnant are standing and waiting, and that's their own thing, and I hadn't thought about it when I was heavily pregnant, okay? And they're delighted with life, like I was delighted with life, do you know, and have since been delighted with life. So you're walking in and you're going through all these heavily pregnant mothers, and I say to the woman, I'm here to see the psychiatrist, and that's grand. And I go to the psychiatrist, and I don't want to rag on her, Elaine, but I'm so angry. I am livid, and I'm screaming and I'm roaring, and I'm like, I don't think you understand. And she says to me, you're a very angry person. And basically at that point, I'm like, well, you. And so I just shut down then, and I'm like, whatever, I actually don't care what you think anymore. So that's fine. And so they recommend this place out near where I live called Sheaf House, which is for people in the community. It's basically like a community nurse for mental health. But people don't realise I don't have a mental health problem. My child is after dying. There is nothing wrong with me, and that's really important. If your child was after dying, you'd feel the same way as I felt. That is so, so important. That I was lost, Elaine, and I didn't know what to do. And so that was fine. The people in the community came in and out, and they weren't for me because they were like, oh, we can do your shopping and we can do this for you and we can do that for you and we can do the other for you. And I just kept saying, those are the things that are keeping me going because they're keeping me busy, you know, so that's fine. And then what happens is eventually I get an appointment with a bereavement midwife, and Anita is her name, and she's absolutely lovely. And she's telling me things, and she does a few things that I don't agree with. And basically she signs this form for yourselves, who I have never heard of before. I had heard of places like A Little Lifetime, and I'd heard of Animcara and all those kind of things. But they weren't for people like me. They were more for people whose children had died either later in life or who had died earlier in life than Finn. So basically directly after birth or during birth or things like that. And that's basically then a few days later, Georgia came out to the house, and the first thing she says to me, she says, it's all right. You're not mad. And I was like, thank God. I was just like, oh, she gets it. She understands. She knows I'm not going off my head. Do you know? And I felt like I'm still obviously under a terrible amount of trauma, but I feel like the weight of the world is after coming off my shoulders because somebody knows. You know, because for so long, you're just like, what am I supposed to do? I've left the hospital with no baby, all his things in a box, and not even a list of phone numbers for people to contact. So you're thinking, right, well, other people, this might happen to them. And they must just be like, right, I'll just go back to work. I'll just do all of these things, you know. And so you're thinking, I'm the mad one. Not even I'm the mad one. I'm having too big a reaction. You know, other people, they just get on with their lives. So it must be me. So when Georgia came out to the house and she says to me, no, you're not going mad, she basically took the weight of the world off my shoulders. Yeah. What happened directly after meeting Georgia is she says, I know exactly what you're talking about. She says, she came out to the house and she says, the first thing she says to me was, you're not going mad. And then she says to me, I know exactly what you're talking about. She says, I've been there myself. So I explained the whole situation to her. And she knew, and she was talking about the names of the tubes and all the different types of heart things. And she kept saying to me, I know, I've heard about it before. I've spoken to mothers in your situation. Do you know what? And it just felt like, oh my God, she gets it. So then what happened was, she says, I'll contact somebody. She says, I'll ring around a few people that I know and I'll see if I can get you in to see somebody as quick as I can. And that's when I met you. And we've been working together, I suppose, Elaine, ever since. Do you know? So in the very, very early times, it's okay to feel every single emotion under the sun. It's okay to be angry. It's okay to lash out. You've had a horrible experience. You've had something happen to you that doesn't happen to most people in their lifetime. Do you know? It's okay for you to feel any mix of emotions that you want to feel. You're not going mad. And that's really the most important thing that I can stress is you're definitely not going off your head. It's totally, totally normal. And just because other people don't understand that and they don't know what to say doesn't mean that your feelings are any less valid. It's fine for you to literally be like, how did they not understand? It's absolutely perfectly normal. And do you know what? There is help out there and there is people who understand. First Light, and I say this a lot, I stress it to people that I know, First Light saved my life. They really did, because I was suicidal. I didn't know where to turn. I didn't know what to do. And do you know what? For people who have never experienced it, it's hard to fathom. And I totally understand that. Before it happened to me, I would have been like, God, imagine being that person, right? But you cope with it because you have no choice. There's a lot of people who say, but how do you do it? It's not that I want to do it. I have to. Do you know? And I suppose the thing is to just listen. Don't offer solutions. Don't offer any of those things. Just listen. And certainly don't tell people that they're too angry or that their emotions are too big, because it doesn't help. All those emotions are totally valid and you wouldn't realise it until it happened to you. You know? So just listen and help where you can. Not that you can really help, but, you know, by offering to do the dishes or, you know, pick up the Tesco's or whatever. Doing those kind of normal tasks that people don't have the energy for in those early days. It really does help. And you know what? The importance of services like your own and like other services I have encountered is people like me, they need to talk, you know, and they need somebody who will just listen. And most importantly, tell them that, you know, it's totally normal to feel the way you feel. It's called grief, you know, that is what's happening to you. And yes, your body feels like it's not your own, but it is totally normal to feel the way you feel. You're not going mad. And there are people who are there to help. And you know what, by supporting services like yours, you're helping people in a way that you never really understood and you don't know is possible. And you know what, it's important as well, it could happen to anyone. You know, it doesn't matter how rich you are or how clever you are or how educated, if it's coming for you. And the really important thing is, you know what, you didn't do anything wrong. You didn't deserve this. Do you know, it just, one of those things, like Terry always says, it was a spelling mistake. You didn't do this, do you know, and that's really important. And when I met Georgia first, that was one of the things she said to me was, yeah, you know what, you're not going mad, but neither did you cause this.
If you or a loved one are struggling with the sudden death of a child and are seeking support, reach out on our website and send us in a referral. We are here to help.